On this episode of This Week in Space, Tarek and I launch you into the world of amateur rocketry. Coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Blue Land. Sometimes in order to go green, you've got to get blue. Blue Land, that is. Blue Land was founded on the belief that a cleaner planet starts by reducing waste while creating powerful, effective cleaners for your entire home. And you can get 20% off your first order when you go to blueland.com/space. And by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV has everything you need to level up your IT skills while you enjoy the journey. Visit itpro.tv/twit for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use code TWIT30 at checkout. Thanks for joining us for This Week in Space. I'm here with my estimable companion, Tarek Malik. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Rod. How are you?
I'm good. How are things at space.com?
Things are busy, as always. We've got...
Yeah.
We've got launches going up. We've got astronauts coming down, but it's all exciting. So,
hopefully soon,
NASA's going to roll out the biggest rocket that they've ever built since the Saturn V, the Space Launch System. So we're really getting excited for that. That could happen pretty soon.
Yeah, and then but we got a rollout and a fueling and so forth test, and then back into the VAB, and then a launch has yet to be determined. Still, correct?
Sometime in the summer. Yes.
Okay, well, that bet still holds. Don't think you're going to get away with anything saying in the summer. That doesn't let you off the hook, my friend. So before we launch into the main act today, Tarek, let's go through a couple of quick headlines that we both noticed. The one that I thought was a bit of a surprise to me anyway was Virgin Orbit setting up shop in Old Blighty. So Virgin Galactic, as we have known and have talked about, is taking some time to get their passenger service up to speed. But a few years ago, in parallel with running the Virgin Galactic tourist flights, they started to develop this system to launch small payloads into space, but in a very unique way, where they take one of their 747s, because they have a bunch of them, and they used to use them a lot, and they carry a rocket up to altitude and drop it off one of the wings and launch it, much like the X-15 used to do. So that's been successful from the U.S. three times, but now they're opening shop in the U.K., which, as far as I know, Tarek, is the first commercial launch service of any kind in the U.K., isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be the first orbital launch from U.K. soil ever, and they're really excited about it. They're going to be launching it out of Spaceport, Cornwall in the western UK, and that's a big moment, not just for Virgin Orbit, because now they'll be launching from two different locations on two different in two different countries, and that's something that they've been advertising, of the flexibility of their launch. You know, they've got this air launch system that on a 747 that they can take off from wherever, and then the UK will be really getting into this commercial space race for small sat launchers. It's going to be a big milestone.
Well, I wish them all the success in the world, because it's been a long trudge to get Virgin Galactic running as a passenger carrying system. And I thought this was a brilliant move on their part when they set up Virgin Orbit. And it's turning out to look like it's going to be a great success. And it's less expensive than a lot of other systems. The payloads are smaller. They max out about 1,100 pounds. But if I understand correctly, there's two big advantages. One, you can launch from almost anywhere. Two, you don't have the same weather constraints you do with a traditional rocket. And three, you can select a really specific orbital path and position for this thing when it's going up, right?
Exactly, yeah. And that's one of their big selling points. In fact, Virgin Orbit has said that they basically can point the rocket wherever it needs to go. You don't have to pick whatever orbits are available from a specific launch site, like the Kennedy Space Center that NASA launches out of, or Vandenberg, where a lot of the Air Force missions are launched out of. You can take off, fly to whatever inclination you need to get to for these orbits and launch. And I don't think they're going to stop at the UK, Rod. I know that Virgin Orbit's been talking with Japan about launching out of airports in Tokyo, and they're definitely looking elsewhere as well to kind of broaden the reach there.
Well, and so in keeping with talking about alternative launch systems, we have a company called VigoRide. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. And I just saw a story that they are preparing to do another series of launches. I think they've tested already. That's about 550 pounds. And these are satellites to low Earth orbit. And there's nothing particularly amazing about that, except that the stage they're sending up with it, which would normally just be the kick stage or the top stage to get into the proper orbit, is actually kind of a space tug, which can stay with the payload for a while, providing power and the ability to maneuver. And it does something that's very hard to do, which is actually move orbital planes and inclination, which I'd like you to explain, because I think you'll do better than I will on that. But with tremendous versatility, up to about 1,250 miles in altitude. And this is something different and kind of a marker for the future of space tugs.
Yeah, this is going to be a really critical not technique, but capability for the future of commercial space, because VigoRide, I love the name, by the way, VigoRide. It reminds me of a Vitamita Vegemin, right? From I Love Lucy, but VigoRide. And what they're billing this as, and I believe the company is Momentus, who's behind VigoRide. They want to set up as a service, so it will launch up and it can be there to move the vehicle around. But changing in inclination, when you go into orbit, you're moving very fast, so it's very difficult to like stop going the direction that you're going and go to a different direction. And they're saying that this tug will be able to do that in order to either reposition satellites or go and visit another satellite if they need to dock and extend its life. And that's a capability that we're going to really need if we want to clean up all the space junk that's up in orbit, if we want to get rid of all the dead satellites that's up there. So this is definitely something that we're going to want to watch going forward, because we know that the U.S. military wants a similar capability for their satellites to do in-space servicing, to do life extension. We know that Intelsat, the communications company, has been using a Northrop Grumman-built space tug to extend the life of its own satellites. So they call them mission extension vehicles, MEVs, and they've already flown two of them. So we're seeing kind of a nascent new use for space and for satellite servicing with these vehicles. And I think we're going to see, you know, this is the second example of this that we want to see how it goes.
Great. And our last story, which you called Astronaut versus Russia in our ongoing conversation about what effects the space industry is going to see with this ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Scott Kelly is back on the news, right?
That's right. NASA astronaut Scott Kelly, one of two only identical twins to fly in space, in a very public argument with Russia's a space program chief, as well as Russian officials. And this week he did say that he wants to give back the medal that Russia gave him for his historic nearly year-long flight with a Russian cosmonaut to the International Space Station. But it's just another sign that there's all of this amid all of the real tragedy in Ukraine that's going on with this war, that there's these kind of cosmic and political ramifications that are reaching all the way to space.
It's going to be, that's kind of a leading edge indicator to me that there is going to be some friction between our astronauts and their cosmonauts. And I hope that they're able to continue working together on the space station as long as possible, at least till we figure out what's going to happen on the space station vis-a-vis the Russians continue to cooperate with us. But, you know, people have to make their comments, and that's one way to do it. All right, we'll be back in just a moment after this quick break to talk about model rockets. Stay with us. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Blue Land. Did you know that an estimated 5 billion plastic hand soap and cleaning bottle containers are thrown away each year? And if that's not bad enough, each bottle can be made of more than 90% water. That is a serious lose-lose situation for our planet. I recently had occasion to spend a few hours with an astronaut who flew on the space shuttle and spent time on the Mir space station. And when we discussed looking back at Earth from space, his most profound impression was that he was looking at something beautiful and fragile. And most astronauts say the same thing. They're in a unique position to see something the rest of us can't see directly, that Earth is a wonderful, fragile home, and that it needs our help. Plastic has been found in 100% of marine turtles, almost 60% of whales, over 36% of seals, and 40% of seabird species examined. By 2050, scientists predict that the ocean will contain more plastic by weight than fish. So start creating a cleaner planet from home. Blue Land's idea is simple and beautiful. Buy the bottle once and refill it forever. The only thing you need to discard is your outdated idea that eco-friendly products are more expensive and less effective. You just fill Blue Land's beautiful Instagrammable bottles with warm water, pop in one of the hand soap or spray cleaner tablets, and within minutes you have powerful cleaning products in the most incredible scents, such as iris agave, perine lemon, and lavender eucalyptus. From their best-selling clean essentials kit to their hand soap duo and plastic-free laundry and dishwasher tablets, Blue Land has something for every inch of your home. And backed by popular demand is Blue Land's toilet tablet cleaner. Get it before it sells out again. Blue Land's stunning, high-quality Forever bottles start at just $10 when you buy a kit and are meant to be reused forever, with money-saving refill tablets that start at just $2. Try Blue Land today. You'll love it, and your planet will thank you. Right now, you can get 20% off your first order when you go to blueland.com/space. That's 20% off your first order of any Blue Land products at blueland.com/space. That's blueland.com/space. So, hey, Tarek.
Yes, Rob.
What did the photon say? What did the photon say to the hotel manager when he offered to help her with her baggage upon arrival?
I don't know what.
He said, "Can I help you with those bags, madam?" And she said, "I'm good, thanks. I'm traveling light." Oh, the
love
whole
it.
The crowd is laughing their heads off. I bet you've got a joke.
What? Oh, you want one for me? Oh, yeah.
I want an astronomer joke.
Okay, good. He's put me on the spot here. Why did the astronomer send his salad back at lunch?
I don't know. Why did the astronomer send his salad back at lunch?
Because he wanted something a bit meatier. Wow.
Judgment call. Judgment call on you. Okay. Well,
it worked. It worked for my daughter when she was five. So I thought it would still hold, but I guess not. So.
God bless our children. Even at five, my kid, when I'd say these things, just look at me and kind of tilt his head like, "Dad, really?" And he already knew what a boomer was then, I'm sad to say. But that's not what we're here to talk about today. We're here to talk about our episode that we like to call You the Rocketeer. So many of us, when we were younger, enjoyed the hobby of model rocketry because we saw NASA launching their big rockets and their astronauts and having these adventures in space. And when you're 8 or 10 or 12 or 14 years old, you really can't be a part of that, although more now than in the past because you could start building CubeSats as a young person. But back at the time, you just kind of watched the major news networks and went, "Oh, that's cool. What can I do?" So what we could do in those days was go out and buy a model rocket kit, which came complete with prepackaged engines, because there was a time, fortunately before my time, or I probably wouldn't be here, that if you wanted to fly a, quote, toy rocket, unquote, you had to either pack black gunpowder or match heads in a steel tube and hope that it didn't explode and hurt your friends, which they often did. So it was good that this was sort of organized into a commercial venture and people could do it safely. And I should say up front here, do as the instructions say under adult supervision. Don't do it. What we're going to talk to Tarek, you hewed pretty close to the rules, but I did a lot of dumb things. So certainly don't do what I do, or what I did. But with that out of the way, let's move along. So let's talk a little bit about what amateur rocketry is, because it's really quite a broad field now. It used to just be a very select number of small toy-like objects that you bought as kits and built, but it's really expanded out. And why don't you give me your definition of what you think amateur rocketry is?
Well, I think amateur rocketry is a really big category. So there's the hobbyists, like you and I, and maybe the bulk of the folks that are listening, who, you know, maybe want to learn how to build like something small, go out to like a baseball diamond or a field that's empty and safe, and then launch some weekend rockets. And so that's what I usually think of when I think of amateur rocketry. You can design them from either pre-made kits or kind of mix and match all of the parts on their own.
Yeah.
But then there's also the maybe more serious amateur rocketeers that are out there. And these are people that may know their way around a machine shop, may actually work with metal instead of cardboard and balsa wood like I do. And
right.
and then go out to somewhere truly remote, like the desert in Mojave, for example, which is a stomping ground of the Southern California Timing Association, where they launch their own liquid fueled model rockets and whatnot. That's like the upper echelon where you really get serious to it. And then of course the next step there is just the sounding rockets for actual science.
Yeah, and I remember, so I really got into this in a big way in my 20s, not when I was a kid, although I started as a kid. And I remember having a conversation with my homeboys about, hey, you know, this has been fun, but, you know, we're launching rockets with propulsive engines that range anywhere from the size of your thumb to maybe the size of a very large cigar. And they're fun, but there are limits to what you can do. You know, you can gang these things together and get a little more boost, but there are limits to what you can do. And I said, let's build a liquid-fueled rocket. That'd be cool. And I got a lot of really funny looks. So that was the end of that experiment, so I never did it. But I have great admiration for the people that do, and I'm going to talk about somebody I know who is in that league a little bit later. So if I may, my entry into this was, I think I was about 8 years old, and I was watching Apollo gear up to go to the moon. And I said to my dad, I want to build a rocket. So he went out and got me a kit from a company called Estes. And there are only two companies then, Estes and Centuri. And it was, as you say, about a foot-long cardboard tube with a balsa wood nose cone and a couple of sheets of balsa wood and some not very detailed instructions that basically told you, okay, cut out some fins, glue them on the rocket, and jam the engine in the back, and off you go. But it ends up being a little more complicated than that. And the bottom line, of course, especially with model rockets, little ones, is if you apply enough power on one end and put a point on the other end, it's going to go up mostly. But if you're really going to do it the way they tell you, you know, you cut the fins out and you sand them to a perfect bevel, and then you put some lacquer over them to fill in the grain in the wood so there isn't drag. And, I mean, they make it this whole big kind of aerodynamic adventure that really is much more than matters. And the only thing I really learned then is don't use hot glue to glue the fins on the rocket, because of course the engines get hot and the fins fly off, and the next thing you know, it's in your eye. And as we know, everything like this is all fun and games until you put an eye out, and that's bad.
Well, alignment is key, Rod. Alignment. That's the thing. You want your fins to be aligned. You want your launch lug. That's like the little straw that you put on the little rail. You want that to be straight. Otherwise it just goes wherever it feels like going.
But that's the fun part. If you can predict everything, how enjoyable is that? All right, so let me finish my story, and then I want to hear your story.
Sure.
So I built this thing, put it on the shelf. Dad, we got to go out and fly the rocket. You know, he's got work to do and all that. And as it turned out, even back then, because it's Southern California, where we like to control everything, there was like two places in the entire county you could go do these. You could fly your rockets. And we never got around to it. Sat on the shelf for years and years and years. And at an age when you were out doing this productively like a responsible citizen, I was grinding my teeth because where I lived, you couldn't fly these things. So it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s and I was running the production division of this television commercial company that we had a lot of spare time and a shop at our disposal. And we thought, well, you know, okay, we're a bunch of young, irresponsible, bored adults. Let's give this a try. So we got into this 3-year cycle where we'd go out every couple of months to Orange County, which is about an hour south of where I live and where we were working. And we'd fly these things. And what I rapidly discovered was that those kits that I had as a young man were way more work than they needed to be. And of course, you know, part of the zen of this is building your rocket, right? And if you are an instructions-oriented person who likes process and being a responsible adult and all that, and who's got time for that, then that's a lot of fun. For me, the fun part was getting just a box of parts and putting them together in different ways and seeing what happened, which makes me feel a little closer to Elon Musk, frankly, although I realize he's brilliant and I'm as far from that as you can get. But that was great fun. So for the next 3 years, we did that. And I think I actually found the one I built as a kid, and it flew once, and then the parachute, you know, had been all gummed up over the years, and it came augering in nose first. And that was the end of my rocket, on which I spent many, many precious hours and tears as a young man. But we moved on from there. But you have a slightly different path.
Yeah, yeah. So when it comes to launching my first rocket, well, I should point out. So I grew up in Central California, not Los Angeles. So in the dead center of the Central Valley in Stockton. My mother was a school teacher, and I remember she came home after not a retreat. I think she like went to some kind of a seminar, and had learned about like launching Estes rockets as like a teaching tool.
Right.
And so she wanted to kind of test it out. And we had friends that had a farm out on the outside of town. And we drove out there for one afternoon. And I remember actually building a rocket out of a paper towel tube. So actual things we had lying around the house. So my mom had these fins, and we made like the nose cone by, you cut that circle and then you make the cone and glued it on. And building that inside part of these Estes rockets, you know, they have these different components where you've got the tube and then you have to have this mount that you used to have to build yourself that would fit these little cylindrical motors. But they were then like glued to the side of the inside of the tube with these rings. And you had to be real careful with how you positioned all of that. And so we actually did this in an afternoon. Then we let it dry and had lunch and went out into the farm field and launched them from there. And I must have been like, you know, 8 or 9. I mean, I wasn't that old back then. And it was just a fun afternoon. I was like, you built something and then you got to go watch it fly. I'm fairly certain that my motor burned through the side of the paper towel tube.
Yeah.
And it didn't go very high, but that was kind of like the kernel. And then after that, we were buying the actual kits from Estes. And we should point out, Estes has been around since like 1958. And it was founded by Vern and I think it's Glada is how you pronounce it, Estes, mm-hmm. out in Colorado. And so the kits have like a track record and a bunch of different skill levels. So I just went on up the skill levels, and I didn't launch 90% of what I built because we just didn't go out to the farms all that often. But I still have those rockets. they're all on top of my bookshelf in my parents' house. And that was the start. I mean, I'd always been interested in space. I built models of space shuttles and models of the Starship Enterprise. There's one that I never finished. but these rockets were always just a joy. And now I've got my daughter, she's 13, and she and I build them too.
And a lot of them, I think there's more plastic parts of them now, but at the time, at least when I was doing it, almost everything was paper and cardboard. And they got pretty elaborate. So there's one that was a Mars lander that had legs that were rubber band loaded and swung out. It had all kinds of fairings and little doodads and fake hatches on it and so forth. And I remember spending, I don't know, probably 3 weeks building this thing exactly to the instructions because I was trying to be good and rein in my ADD and be a responsible citizen. And on the way up, about half that stuff came flying off. And of course, you know, when you change aerodynamics or something, it likes to go in a different direction. And it immediately ended up as a smoldering clump on the ground, which was not heartening. And I think that's when I first got the idea that, okay, so the build, you know, unless you're an avid modeler, and I respect people that are, because there are people that do amazing work in miniature reproductions. I was just interested in putting together something interesting that would go up and maybe not burn. And by the way, you probably learned at one point where you're doing this, something that no listener should do, which is if you strike these are solid rocket motors. These aren't liquid. So this is just basically a cardboard tube filled with chemical compounds that burn at a controlled rate. And then they have a little explosive charge at the end to pop the parachute out at the end of the flight. And if you whack that in just the right spot with a hammer, instead of boosting the parachute out, they go kaboom. And the kaboom's not so bad because it's just a bunch of paper in the sky, but you should never do that.
Yeah, do not. Don't try that at home. Protect your rockets.
So we tried to get organized, flipping back to my 20s here. We called ourselves the ARMs, which nominally stood for Association of Rocket Modelers, but actually stood for something that I can't say on the air. And our model was Look Out Below, and we had one of our animators make this fantastic logo of a rocket with its fist out and its cape trailing behind it, glowering at the ground. And I was fortunate, one of my companions in this effort was a gentleman named Gary Hutzel, who was a camera assistant there, who later went on to be one of the two effects guys behind Star Trek The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, where I worked with him for a couple of years. And he was just a brilliant guy. He was one of those people that could grab any box of electronic parts and pretty much build anything, which has always just baffled the heck out of me because I can't do that. And so I said, you know, I built with a couple of friends, I built this fancy launch gantry with flame troughs and flags flying and all this kind of stuff to give us a respectable thing, you know, better than just a metal rod and some legs, which is how you normally launch them. And he said, how about if I build a countdown computer? And I said, that's cool. So he built a countdown computer out of an old Radio Shack kit. We went out there for the first day of this rig and set the whole thing up. And I was watching him put this together for the afternoon. And he had a button in the box. You know, he had one that says start countdown, stop countdown, emergency, and question mark. I said, what's the question mark for? And he said, oh, that's the launch randomizer. I said, what's a launch randomizer? So he showed me. So he pushed that button, and this voice, this computerized voice said, preparing to launch, clear the launch area, 10, 9, 3, 5, ignition. So whenever we wanted to actually get the crowd riled up, we'd hit the randomizer, and you never knew it was going to take off, which I thought was kind of cool. But as the day went on, and you get more creative and you get sort of bored with the retail versions of things, we began to realize this idea of applying power at the rear end of anything. So by the end of the month, we had shot up a half-eaten chicken leg, which did not have a parachute, but it flew. It flew very well, actually. I guess we just happened to nibble it down to aerodynamic dimensions. A salad colander, which doesn't go very high because it's full of holes, but, you know, it does fly straight. But I think my favorite was Skyrocket Barbie, and we did have Skyrocket Ken, just to be fair, which was a doll, you know, looking very proud atop a small tube with a rocket engine. And Barbie flew very well. Unfortunately, again, parachutes are, you know, optional, and she came down kind of hard and disastrously. But it did make me think that maybe I was onto something I should be talking to Mattel about, but oddly, they weren't interested in that idea. The best launch of the day was the Batrock, which was about 6 feet high. Because as long as they're made out of paper, right, you can make it as big as you want. You just have to put more oomph at the bottom. And the Batrock was, this was when Batman, the first two Batman movies were out, was red and black and yellow. And had a lower structure connected to an upper structure with a couple of long struts. And the parachute was a 4-foot silk disc with the Batman Searchlight logo on it. So that was a crowd pleaser. That got everybody awesome. Riled up, and we got lots more attention than we probably deserved. But I think you flew things a slightly more organized way, which is advisable.
So basically, I just followed the instructions for my stuff. I really liked a lot of the scale stuff. Now, I didn't back in the 80s when I was growing up and launching the rockets as a kid. Not now. There were things that I just couldn't. They were a little bit beyond my price range. Like there was the Estes versions of the space shuttle, which I never had the chance to get my hands on and build. And even the scaled ones, like the Saturn V's and those other types of rockets, I didn't have. So I had these the Bullpup, you know, which was these missile recreations. Those were the ones that I had the most, and there was one that I saved, and it was like a starfighter, and it was so pretty that I did not launch it, Rod, because I have to say I was afraid of losing it. So that is one that never flew that I might have a chance to launch now. But the biggest things that we flew were like the mosquitoes. They're really tiny ones. Some of them you didn't even need to have a parachute. They just used They either
tumble back, right?
Yeah, they shuttlecock down, or they have a streamer, and those were the ones that I remember the most because they were fast to launch, and the engines were a lot more affordable too. So, you know, we should probably point out that the rockets that we're talking about they're mostly the Estes line because it's like the biggest company that's out there. You mentioned Century. I read that actually they merged together when Century was going out of business, so they absorbed them in the past. And so you would have to buy kind of three or four different things if you're going to be serious about launching these hobby rockets. You buy the kits themselves or the parts like Rod did. And then you have to buy the actual motors, which come usually three to a pack and at different sizes for how high you want the rocket to go and how big the rocket is. And then there's the launch legs and the little heat element that heats up your motor and your controller and your launch set and everything. So I had the launch set.
Right?
Yeah, the igniter. Yeah, that's it's a it's like electric wire that heats up and then it ignites the actual motor itself. And there's some wadding that you can get. Don't use tissue because that will melt and your parachutes and all of that stuff. So when we went to space camp, that was like the next big round of launching rockets. And so they have a standard one that has a see-through payload. You can put a Twinkie in there. You could put a little Lego guy, that kind of thing. And so we did that a couple of times. Yeah. And then one year that I was there, because I went a couple of times, we were with the group that had already done it before and were a little bored. And one of the team members brought these big motors that we weren't allowed to use. They're D-size motors for the big rockets. And he just crammed them in our rocket. And then we glued everything shut so that the nose cone wouldn't pop off where the parachute is to parachute back to Earth. And when you do that, the motors all have a little puff on the top of them when they burn out. They have a little... a little explosion inside the tube that is designed to push out the parachute and pop the nose cone off. And when you glue the nose cone on, Rob, that doesn't happen. And it doesn't actually pop off. And so he had
but
crammed.
But it pops the rocket, right?
It pops the rocket. And it blew our rocket apart. And it made the biggest bang out of any of the other launches there. And it was glorious. We had so much fun. You know what? Don't do that at home, though, right? So if you want to recover your rocket... If you want to recover your rocket, make sure that that you follow the instructions and launch things safely.
And there are people that get into this to a level, and some of these things are available as retail kits. There used to be a thing called Camrock, another one called CineRock. Camrock would go up, and when it tipped over, I think it had a mercury switch in it, basically something that said, okay, I'm upside down, take a picture, and you'd get a little tiny... maybe half-inch wide negative. So you'd get a picture of your launch site from a couple hundred feet up, which then was exciting in the era of drones. It's kind of a so what. And then the CineRock had a little 8mm film cartridge, and it would take a movie sometimes. It didn't actually work very well, but it was a cool idea. So that's you got excited. You could do these more involved things. And now people, of course, because electronics are miniaturized and you're not flying vacuum tubes and mainframes like you'd have to when I was a kid, you can actually track your rocket and you know when it comes down, you know where it is. Because finding them after they land, either softly or as a disaster, can be difficult. One thing I learned was we went to one cleared rocket range out in the San Fernando Valley and heard all this buzzing and looked over and realized there are guys flying their model planes, their toy airplanes, quote unquote, over about a quarter mile away. And, when I say toy airplanes, I mean, these are people that spend thousands of dollars building these beautiful scale versions of F-16s and B-17s and anything else you can imagine and flying them with remote controllers. And I have a lot of respect for what they do because that is an intense, expensive, exacting hobby. You got to be really good at what you're doing. And we were flying our rockets off to the side. And as usual, I was doing my, I can launch anything if I try hard enough. And one of them went off course a little bit. And it didn't hit the guy's plane, but it headed in their direction. So we're yucking it up and laughing and, let's have another Coke and talk about what we're going to try and damage next. And this guy comes stomping over and I was probably 26. He was in his 50s. And he was wearing a full flight suit. It was a green military flight suit, top to bottom, zipped up the front with squadron patches of his model airplane squadron and stuff. So I could tell he was taking this kind of seriously. And he was really angry because we had impinged on, not that we had endangered his plane, but we had impinged on his airspace, which was a concept foreign to me, right? Because it's just the sky, as far as I'm concerned. It's like, if I can look up and see a clear blue, I can launch a rocket. But he had, in his mind, circumscribed airspace that we had violated, and he was going to call the cops.
Can you imagine being a cop and
having somebody call you and say, he invaded my airspace? Yeah, sure, buddy.
Well, you bring up two really important parts about planning any kind of amateur rocket. Yeah. If you are going to launch a rocket, number one is make sure that you go to a place that is remote and that it has a lot of space and that it's nice and flat. So you're not too close to trees where you're going to lose your rockets. And like I learned when we just recently went to go launch some rockets, you're not too close to a bunch of kids playing soccer at the next field over that your rocket might fall into, because you don't want that to happen either. And number two, you mentioned the police. Please make sure that you research your city and your state ordinances and that you have them on hand when you go and launch, because model rocketry, for Estes at least, is usually allowed most places because they can sell them at hobby shops and whatnot. But sometimes the authorities may not know about that statute, and you want to have it on hand and not get a ticket for disturbing the peace or whatever. So
because that'll really ruin your afternoon.
So in New Jersey, you can find it at the newjersey.gov if you search model rockets, because that's where I live in New Jersey. And I always have that open on my phone when I'm
It's a lot more organized than it used to be. And speaking of soccer fields, I learned a very interesting lesson about higher power rocketry. So I got my hands on an F engine. So it goes A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, and so forth. And they get more expensive, more powerful as they go up. An F engine's about... I guess about 7 inches long and about maybe an inch and a half in diameter. So the important thing is, you know, it's got more bang stuff in it, right? And so I got an F engine and I got a model that was supposed to be appropriate for F engines, and I built it. But the nose cone was a little loose. And I thought, well, that's not good. So I cut some little cardboard tabs and glued them around the perimeter like a collar to help hold it in place, which I thought was brilliant. Because I'm not an engineer. So I got this thing out there and launched it, and up it went. And one of those little tabs bent sideways. And of course, you know, what's that? Well, that's a fin in the wrong place. And the rocket veered violently off course. And I watched the smoky trail go up and arc over and then go down under power, and heard kind of a crump at the other end of it. And I thought, well, I better go retrieve that. Had no idea that out in this supposedly remote area we were doing this, that there was a little league game taking place just down the way. And so we walked over towards the perimeter of the baseball park, and I'm looking, and I see this cluster of angry fathers cradling baseball bats. And I thought, well, I've got two choices here. I can do the smart thing and just walk away, or I can man up and go over and apologize. So I walked over, and it had come down right on the first baseline and made a neat little crater. They were more understanding about it than I probably would have been. I did get asked a few times about who the hell I thought I was and this kind of thing, legal and all that. So I picked up the crumpled remains of my poor rocket and made a bowing retreat, facing them the entire time, because those bats were looking pretty uncomfortable. But don't add extra parts if you don't understand what they're going to do, is the lesson there.
And I have to clean off. I just recently tested an Estes Blue Origin New Shepard rocket now, because they still make scale model rockets.
Yeah.
This is a new rocket that Estes released in November, and it's in partnership with Blue Origin. This is not a kit. It's an actual model version of a New Shepard rocket that is all plastic, so there isn't a lot of build to it. So kind of the reason that you got into rocketry, probably not the reason for this one. So I did launch it, but I did not pack my parachute tight enough, and it did get a bit stuck inside. It's neat. There's a little capsule. You can put a little payload inside, but when you overstuff your parachute, it doesn't pop open free enough, and it did auger in and hit the ground. It's still in good shape. I'm surprised. I was really just afraid that I would lose the rocket, but it is something that you have to be careful about, all that stuff when you're preparing the nose cone and the parachute and everything.
Well, and I will add just a hint for anybody who's getting any ideas about these payload capsules, because they do make kits with payload capsules. Please don't put mice and other living things in there, because it's really, they're not trained astronauts, you know, and they're not William Shatner, who got coaching at the age of 90 to fly in a rocket. They're little scared creatures, and that's very bad for them. So I want to talk, just as we're wrapping up here, a little bit about bigger toy rockets.
Yes.
As a gentleman, a wonderful guy that I know named Steve Jurvetson, who is a high-tech investor, and he put money into SpaceX in 2008 when they were in a critical state. And we're talking $100 million and more. These are not small investments. Which helped them move forward and reach the success they have. He's got investments in Planet Labs and many other things. And he's one of those guys that when you spend time with him, so I've interviewed him twice, and it's like you sit down in a room with this fellow who got through Stanford Engineering in a little over 2 years, which you're not supposed to do, but he's that smart. And he starts talking, and he's really passionate and engaged, and these ideas are coming a mile a minute, and it's like somebody sucks the oxygen out of the room, and you begin feeling a little woozy because you're around a truly brilliant mind, which I don't share. And so he's an amazing guy. So we had our interview about space business and all that, And he said, have you ever flown model rockets? And I said, well, yes. And I built my own from scratch. You know, and I'm thinking about that we're both on the same page with Estes D engines or something. And I
yeah,
said,
you're an expert, right?
He said, yeah, well, so I thought. He said, well, you know, I fly a slightly different type of rocket. So we go out. I think he goes out to Black Rock in Nevada, which is one of those areas you were talking about in the desert, where it's just miles and miles of dirt that you can't really damage because there's nothing to burn or hurt. And they're specially cleared for this, and they actually clear their airspace. So he showed me pictures of his rockets, and they're really not rockets. They're missiles, right? So these things are maybe 6 to 8 inches in diameter. They might be as much as 10 feet high. And I said, what do you power that with? He said, oh, I get surplus cruise missile boost engines. And he showed me one because he's got this... probably the greatest collection of space paraphernalia outside in private hands anyway. And he's got ejection seats and real rocket engines, that kind of stuff. But he showed me one of these boost stages and I thought, oh, wow, that's a serious rocket. So that's impressive. Two other things come to mind. There was a group sometime around the Apollo 11 anniversary. And I know you've got a story about this too. There's a group that built a Saturn V. And it might have been liquid fueled, I'm not sure, but it was probably 30 feet high, I would think. So it's a scale rocket, but it's scale on a whole different scale, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And they had a bunch of people and support trucks and all this and radios and they're standing by and all that kind of thing. And it was magnificent for no other reason because when they hit ignition, it, like the real thing, it sat there for a second and then slowly and majestically rose, flew great. It was one of those kind of, you almost get little weepy moments because they're clearly so committed. This was a huge investment. And if you look on YouTube for big Saturn V model rocket, you'll find it. But I think the one I admire the most, have you ever watched Top Gear, the BBC mm-hmm, yes. show when it was on? They took, I believe it was a Reliant Robin, which is one of the most hated cars in British history. It's a three-wheel car that liked to tip over and tumble more than it liked to drive straight. And they made it into a scale model of the space shuttle. And they launched that on a great big scale, quote, toy, unquote, rocket. And it worked, and it went up, and it came down. And I think they destroyed it at the end of the episode. But that was... inspired, goofy, but magnificent at the same time. And so one of my aspirations when I grow up someday is to fly something large like that. So if you don't watch it, next time you're in California, I may stick you inside of a Mini Cooper and see how high we can get you. So be careful when you visit, will you?
We'll do.
Okay, this has been fun. Let's take a break here from one of our sponsors, and then we'll come back to talk about a responsible approach to the hobby of rocketry. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Now, if you're a regular listener to this show, you know that we're entering a new space age. Between NASA, Space Force, and companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, and dozens of others, they need people qualified in IT. These skills are more indispensable than ever. IT Pro TV can be a stepping stone to a career in the most exciting adventure of the 21st century. Are you thinking about getting your CCNA certification? Having your CCNA shows you're knowledgeable in networking fundamentals, IP services, security fundamentals, automation, and programmability. IT Pro TV has the classes and skills you need in everything Cisco. And the month of March is dedicated to Cisco at IT Pro TV. Check out their free weekend, March 19th and 20th, including these courses. Cisco CCT Routing and Switching, 100 through 490, and Cisco CCNA, 200 through 301, and a variety of others. Learn to get certified in IT in a way that works with your schedule and is actually entertaining. IT Pro TV has 7 studios that are filming Monday through Friday, and those courses go from the studio to their course library in 24 hours. They make sure that you're prepared for your exams with their virtual labs and practice tests. You don't want to miss IT Pro TV's March webinars either. On March 24th, check out the Cisco NAAS webinar featuring Anthony Sequeira. Don't forget, your IT team needs to level up and enjoy the journey. Check out an IT Pro TV business plan for your team today. Visit itpro.tv/twit for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use code TWIT30. That's itpro.tv/twit and use code TWIT30 for an additional 30% off the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV. build or expand your IT career, and enjoy the journey. And now back to the show.
Rod, I was thinking that we might want to give some folks some basic tutorials. If they want to,
are you going to do this about, right? Okay, all right.
We've been telling stories like the whole time.
Please do.
Our old yarns. So yeah, so I just wanted to kind of give folks a guide because I've got a 13-year-old daughter, and building rockets with her is a lot of fun. There's a couple of places that you can look. I mean, if you do an easy Google search, you'll find Estes pretty easy. But there's another company, Apogee Rockets, where these. You can find the scale model types of rockets that Rod is talking about. So you've got those kinds of sources, but there are rocketry groups that people can sign up with. There's one in Maryland near NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, for example, and that's where you can kind of gather and share your hobby. And at there, that's only a few hours drive for me. They actually have like a monthly launch, or they did, you know, before the ongoing pandemic, where people could get together and then you would have a launch-a-thon. And those are really kind of fun events. And what we've done with my daughter and her friends is we've gotten together, you know, where everyone builds a rocket and then you spend an afternoon actually doing that. And some things to think about for the hobby itself is how much do you want to spend, right? Because it depends on the rockets come in different tiers, and how much time do you want to spend building the rockets? Many of the rockets, I kind of fell out of love in the early 90s because the Estes rockets had transitioned to be much more prefabricated. And now for entry, for like young kids and whatnot, that's really helpful because they don't have to fiddle with the fins
right.
that you do. So you can really select your skill level for what you're trying to get out of the hobby itself. So if you're going to launch with kids, I would suggest looking at those lower skill levels where the rockets are a bit faster to put together, because if your children are like mine, they'll see you open the rocket and want to launch it like in like 3 minutes.
Right.
But if you want to dedicate some time, you can look for those really highly detailed models that we can work on it in your hobby shop over time with some plastic cement, paint and whatnot, and then go out. But sharing it with friends, I think, and Rod, you touched on this, is one of the best parts of the hobby. I used to launch with my cousins, and I found that is a lot more fun, and you get a lot of more inventive approaches to how to paint the rockets, how to decorate them, and maybe even how to design them when you design them out of whole cloth, because these right. companies will provide bulk supply kits that will come with different size tubes, different size fins, even different types of nose cone shapes and parachutes. And you can mix and match. I like to cut a hole in my parachutes. If you can imagine a piece of plastic that's the shape like a hexagon, and right in the middle is a big round circle, that's the company's logo. And I always cut that part out because it lets more air in and your rockets will come down faster. Some people like their rockets to dangle and come down real slowly. But if you're launching in even a mild wind, you might have a long run to go catch that rocket on the way back right. down. So those are some things just to consider when you're trying to decide where you want to go. And then, of course, you do need a launch set. So you need to have a launch pad and batteries for your controller and all of that. So those are some things that you're going to want to make sure that you have in advance prepared.
Well, and you bring up a couple of really good points I'd just like to reiterate. You know, this is something that's really great to do with your kids, and I've enjoyed being able to lather everybody up with my stories of poor behavior, but the way to do it right with your kids is to do it right and follow the instructions, use the kits until you've worked up to a spot where you can scratch build and you've really learned how things work. But in today's world, where kids spend a lot of time, of course, as we all did in school, but a lot of their spare time playing computer games, using their phone, these kind of inward-oriented activities, to be able to go out with your parents and with friends as a group and do something in the real world that shoots items up into the sky, even if they're not into space particularly, is thrilling. I have never seen a young person, and this all the way up through teens, who went out and did this and wasn't kind of transformed by it, because it's very visceral. You know, these things, and they take off, and they go up, and hopefully they come back in good shape. But you have a real sense of accomplishment and doing something exciting and real. So I highly recommend it.
Yeah, we just went out recently. We had weeks and weeks of frigid weather, and we had one 70-degree day, and it was amazing. So it's like, we got to go outside, and we got to go do something. And we went out with my daughter and her friend and the friend's little brother, and these are like super video game kids. And the minute that rocket gets off the ground, they are running like I did when I was 6 or 7, you know, or I think I was 8, to go catch this thing, and wondering like, how did they open up the capsule? Did the little Lego person survive? Yes, it's still there, and it's all in one piece. That's amazing. Now they're using smartphones and whatnot to capture the launches. That's something that we didn't do. We didn't even have cameras to take picture of things because it all happened too fast. But it is that sense of doing something where you're not glued, where you're doing something different and it's fun. There's some frustration because the igniters, you have to position them properly inside the motors themselves. And there's a special lug that comes with them that you have to make sure so that it'll heat up properly, ignite this solid propellant and go. And when that doesn't happen, you know, you're holding the button to launch and nothing's going on. You're really frustrated. That happened to us 3 or 4 times because of how loose our lug was, but we were still able to get through it. And we had an amazing time.
Well, this has been fun. And I want to thank everybody for indulging us while we talked about one of our fun madcap hobbies of the past, and do look into it if you get a chance. And thanks for listening. We'd love to hear from you, good, bad, or indifferent. If you want to send us an email, send it to us at twis@twit.tv. That's twis@twit.tv, and we'll get your email and respond in a fashion that we find appropriate. Also, be sure to subscribe to the show today at twit.tv/twis. That's twit.tv/twis, or find us on a major podcatcher. And be sure to hit that subscribe button, because every little bit helps. Thanks very much. Next week, we'll be back to real space news. So we'll take it back where it belongs. And it's been an awful lot of fun. So thanks, and we'll see you then.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club Twit. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club Twit Discord, a great clubhouse for Twit listeners. And finally, the Twit Plus feed, with shows like Stacy's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit. And thanks for your support.